15. Chia Skulls and Mummy Powder. The ancients were very eager to embalm the bodies of their dead, but not with the intention that they should serve as food and drink for the living, as is the case at the present time. Ambroise Paré, 1582, cited in Consuming Grief by Beth Conklin. As secretaries and colleagues began to move into Dr. Bill Ahrens's office with greater frequency, I could tell that my interview with the anthropologist was drawing to a close. I decided to go for broke, pressing him for some acknowledgement that ritualized cannibalism existed, somewhere. So, Dr. Ahrens, which example of ritual cannibalism do you find hardest to refute, and why? Well, he replied, it depends on the definition of ritual cannibalism. Because if you think that grinding up body parts and using them for medicinal purposes is ritual cannibalism, then I would find that the most difficult to reject. I should mention that in 1998, Ahrens had previously acknowledged that the existence of rituals involving the ingestion of culturally processed human body parts is open to further consideration. Referring to a reported instance of bone ash cannibalism by the Amhuaca of the Peruvian-Brazilian border, Ahrens admitted that he had been unreasonable in denying its occurrence. But you don't consider that cannibalism, do you? I do. I do consider that cannibalism, Ahrens said, and I'm sure he was taking some satisfaction at my shocked expression. I think if people in South America grind up bones and ingest them, and people in America grind up organs and ingest them, then it's cannibalism. But I think you either have to say that this is not cannibalism, or they're both cannibals. You can't choose between them. And so if you accept that this type of behavior is cannibalism, then that would be the most difficult to reject because it takes place. It has taken place. Some things you call ritual cannibalism are impossible to deny or reject. I left the interview with a new respect for Ahrens, who'd taken major heat from his colleagues for claiming that there was no first-hand evidence that ritualized cannibalism ever had existed in any society. But rather than trumpeting a belief that ritual cannibalism never occurred, what Ahrens had actually done was to knock down a hornet's nest and then give it a kick in order to make some extremely relevant points. One of these concerned the racism inherent in applying the cannibal tag to a cultural group, a practice undertaken by a long list of flag-planting invaders and those who accompanied and followed them. Keenly aware that the Western cannibal taboo had reduced these indigenous inhabitants to subhuman status, the invaders were able to justify the use of any form of behavior, no matter how inhumane, in order to subjugate and, in many instances, utterly destroy cultural groups of every size, wherever they were encountered. Ahrens and others like him have forced us to revise our views on the age of discovery, as well as the explorers we have, perhaps, too long regarded as heroes. One needs only to look at the growing push to celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day instead of Columbus Day to see this revision in action. Ahrens was also at least partially responsible for an increase in the scientific rigor with which fellow researchers explored cannibalism-related topics. Although the theoretical possibility of customary, that is, ritual cannibalism, cannot be dismissed, he wrote in The Man-Eating Myth, the available evidence does not permit the facile assumption that the act was or ever has been a prevalent cultural feature. It's probably no coincidence that, since the publication of his book in 1979, anthropologists have developed and adhere to a clear-cut set of criteria when attempting to validate claims of cannibalism in their study groups, whether those groups are extinct or extant. The overall effect has been that the majority of anthropologists now believe that ritual cannibalism was practiced by fewer cultural groups throughout history than was previously thought. In all likelihood, this has resulted from an increased degree of scrutiny being applied to any proposed evidence of cannibal-related behavior. I am convinced that these two outcomes were Ahrens's true goals. As for those who might wonder why he had ruined his reputation, in reality, he hadn't. he has plenty of 21st century supporters who now agree with the read between the lines contributions he made in 1979. And even his detractors can't help plastering his name all over their own papers. I'm certain Dr. Ahrens is amused. Ahrens's examples of consuming pulverized human bones or organs in order to treat some malady fall under the general heading of medicinal cannibalism, which is, once you consider it, a form of ritual cannibalism. But however it's classified, the practice is as interesting as it is little known. It turns out that medicinal cannibalism was once widespread throughout Western culture, although reference to it has essentially disappeared from the historical record. The same, however, cannot be said for the Chinese, whose literature, medical texts, and historical accounts span over 2,000 years and contain detailed descriptions of the preparation and use of body parts as curatives. Scholar Ki-Rae Chong wrote that the first documented use of organs and human flesh to cure diseases in China took place during the later Han period, 25 to 220 CE, and that medicinal cannibalism became increasingly popular beginning in the Tang Dynasty, 618 to 907 CE, when it became associated with filial piety. By the end of the Jing Dynasty, 1644 to 1912, Western missionary doctors were reporting that the Chinese medical treatments included the consumption of the gallbladder, bones, hair, toes, and fingernails, heart, and liver. Thomas Chen, a pathology professor at the New Jersey Medical School, tells us that nail, hair, skin, milk, urine, urine sediments, gall, placenta, and even flesh were used in China for a variety of medicinal purposes. But what about the reports of medicinal cannibalism in Europe, some of it taking place into the 20th century? Considering how outraged the Spanish were upon learning about the man-eating behavior of the indigenous people of the Caribbean, one might assume that cannibalism of any kind would have been frowned upon. But that was certainly not the case. As it turns out, many Renaissance-enlightened Christians from Spain, England, France, Germany, and elsewhere turned to medicinal cannibalism to treat a long list of problems. From kings to commoners, Europeans routinely consumed human blood, bones, skin, guts, and body parts. They did it without guilt, though it often entailed a healthy dose of gore. They did it for hundreds of years. Then they made believe that it never happened. Perhaps the most commonly consumed human tissue is blood, a substance that has, until fairly recently, been misunderstood. Until the 20th century, most of what we knew, or thought we knew, about blood could be traced to the 2nd century Greek physician Claudius Galenus, known as Galen. Physician to the Roman gladiators, Galen stressed the importance of four bodily humors: blood, black bile, yellow bile, and the smoker's favorite, phlegm. According to Galen, keeping the body's humors in balance was the key to good health, both mental and physical. Unfortunately, this doctrine would become the party line for medical practitioners for well over 1,000 years, with Galen's followers routinely involved in serious bouts of bleeding, gorging, and purging, the latter from both ends. Since Galen believed that blood was the most important of the humors, bloodletting, usually initiated with a blade called a lancet, was prescribed to treat everything from fever and headaches to menstruation. Some of this blood, though, ended up back in the patient where it was consumed to treat epilepsy. So popular was this practice that public executions routinely found epileptics standing close by, cup in hand, ready to quaff their share of the red stuff. But drinking down blood while it was hot and fresh was not the only way to take one's medicine. It was also dried and made into powder or mixed into an elixir with other ingredients. Most interesting to me was that consuming blood turned out to be far more than a medieval folk remedy, as evidenced by the fact that English physicians were still prescribing it as late as the mid-18th century. Although Galen's mistaken views would dominate the field of medicine for 1,500 years, the continued popularity of medicinal cannibalism can be primarily attributed to the rise of an alternative medical doctrine initiated by Philippus Aureolus Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenheim. better known as Paracelsus, 1493 to 1541. The Swiss physician is considered by some to be the father of chemical pharmacology and therapeutics, due to his pioneering use of substances like mercury, sulfur, and opium. He has also been called the world's first toxicologist. Still, many of Paracelsus's beliefs were founded on bizarre magic like alchemy, often infused with astrological mumbo-jumbo. Long after his death, his followers touted a medical philosophy that stressed the healing powers of the human body, but not in the manner we're familiar with. Rather, Paracelsian physicians often prescribed medications made from human body parts. For example, they might give epileptics a potion containing powdered human skull, a substance that they believed did double duty as a cure for dysentery. Richard Sugg, author of the 2011 book Mummies, Cannibals, and Vampires, The History of Corpse Medicine from the Renaissance to the Victorian, writes that every imaginable body part was used, including human liver, oil distilled from human brains, pulverized heart, bladder stones, warm blood, breast milk, and extract of gall. Also popular in medicinal concoctions were bones, flesh, and fat, the latter applied to wounds or taken internally to treat rheumatism. During the European Renaissance, the popularity of medicinal cannibalism may have begun with the great unwashed masses, but it was soon adopted as de rigueur by the enlightened, pious, and well-heeled. Upper-class types, and even members of the British royalty, applied, drank, or wore concoctions prepared from human body parts, and they continued to do so until the end of the 18th century. According to Sugg, "One thing we are rarely taught at school, yet is evidenced in literary and historic texts of the time, is this. James I refused corpse medicine. Charles II made his own corpse medicine, and Charles I was made into corpse medicine." Additional high-profile advocates of medicinal cannibalism included Francis I, King of France, Jacopo Berengario da Carpi, Italian anatomist, John Donne, poet and priest, Francis Bacon, pioneer of the scientific method, John Bannister, surgeon to Elizabeth I, John Hall, physician and Shakespeare's son-in-law, and Robert Boyle, natural philosopher, chemist, and inventor. With an ever-increasing demand for human body parts, the popularity of public executions rose dramatically in the 17th century. The already gruesome events became even gorier as the choicest cuts were harvested from prisoners, often while they were still alive. In what was described as a typical account from 1660 London, a prisoner has his privy members cut off before his eyes and his bowels burned. He was then decapitated and his head set on a pole. Finally, his body was cut into quarters, perhaps to maximize its value when divvied up for medicinal purposes or displayed upon some of the city gates. Human skulls not ground into powder were often left out in the air, where they served as the substrate for skull moss, a curative applied topically to stem bleeding and to treat disorders of the head. Researcher Paolo Modenesi believes that the term actually refers to a taxonomic assemblage of mosses and lichens. Renowned for their ability to thrive on bare rock, these organisms had little difficulty growing on the calcium-rich crania. Ideally, the moss from the skulls of hanged men was preferred, but according to naturalist and philosopher Robert James, 1703 to 1776, Paracelsus believed that moss grown on the bodies of the unburied dead was quite acceptable. One set of directions showed just how easy it was to transform a skull into the medieval equivalent of a chia pet. The recipe called for the moss collected from a meadow in April to be dried and ground into a powder. This was sprinkled with a strong sweet wine to form a paste, which was spread over the cranium of a carcass that had been broken on the wheel. Gardeners were advised to place their chia skulls in the sun and warned to take them indoors when it rained. The lichen, Usnea humana, was also the main ingredient in a preparation called unguentum armarium, or weapon ointment. This preparation, which also contained human blood and fat, was employed in a bizarre medical treatment known as Hoplochrisma. Hoplin equals weapon, chrisma equals salve. Those administering this procedure might bandage a wound, but would otherwise leave it untreated. They would use the ointment itself on either the weapon that had caused the injury, if available, or a wooden facsimile of it. Given the fact that hoplochrisma had no side effects, it might be classified as one of the most effective treatments available at the time, even if the benefits were simply a result of the placebo effect. Perhaps the most famous example of European medicinal cannibalism was the curious custom of pulverizing mummies to produce a substance known as mummia. This was either consumed, often as a drink ingredient, or applied topically as a salve or in a cloth compress. Mummia was used in the treatment of ailments ranging from epilepsy and bruising to hemorrhaging and upset stomachs. The problem was that there were only a limited number of Egyptian mummies being sent to Europe, leading to shortages and legions of grumpy mummy fans. In response, a thriving cottage industry popped up to supply ersatz mummia. Reportedly, by the end of the 17th century, the quality of bootleg mummy had gotten so bad that buyers were advised to choose what is of a shining black, not full of bones and dirt, and of a good smell. There were, however, some high-quality artificial mummies to be had, or at least a recipe for their production, as anthropologist Karen Gordon Grube discovered in the official London Pharmacopoeias of the 17th century. The Paracelsist Oswald Kroll recommended that mummy be made of the cadaver of a red-headed man, aged 24, who had been hanged. The corpse was to lie in cold water in the air for 24 hours, after which the flesh was cut in pieces and sprinkled with a powder of myrrh and aloes. This was soaked in spirit of wine and turpentine for 24 hours, hung up for 12 hours, again soaked in the spirit mixture for 24 hours, and finally hung up to dry. In an interesting turn of fate, the popularity of grinding up mummies for medicinal purposes may have started because of a mistranslation. Apparently, Arabs often used the petroleum-based substance we call tar or bitumen as an adhesive and to staunch wounds. Their word for this material was mumia, but it also became their word for the mummified human remains they discovered after taking over Egypt in the 6th century CE. The Arabs mistakenly believed the mummies to have been prepared with bitumen during the preservation process. Centuries later, Europeans heard about the medicinal benefits of mumia. Unfortunately, they wound up hoarding mumia, the dried-up dead guys, rather than mumia, the tarry stuff. Either the locals never figured out the screw-up, which seems highly unlikely, or they simply never bothered to tell the Europeans about it. As a consequence, mummy powder was available at the Merck Pharmacy in Darmstadt, Germany until 1908. Listed as Mumia Vera Egyptica, it sold for 17.50 marks per kilogram. Essentially, then, as European adventurers, missionaries, and colonists were condemning the indigenous people they encountered for practicing cannibalism, their own rulers and countrymen in Europe were consuming human body parts to a degree and at a rate that would have made Hannibal Lecter proud. Until, that is, they stopped. Richard Sugg, the foremost expert on the topic, believes that the practice of medicinal cannibalism was abandoned because of the rise of Enlightenment attitudes to science, superstition, and the general backwardness of the past, a desire to create a newly respectable medical profession, a changing attitude towards hygiene, the body, and disgust, and the radically changed nature of the human body itself. The latter development Sugg described as a more mechanized model of the human body, an entity now drained, at least for the educated, of its animistic, essentially cosmic vitality. In short, its spirit and soul were gone, although not in every case. In 2002, stories began circulating that Keith Richards had mixed his dad's ashes with some cocaine and snorted them shortly after Burt Richards' death that year. "Not so," replied Keith. "After having Dad's ashes in a black box for 6 years, because I really couldn't bring myself to scatter him to the winds, I finally planted a sturdy English oak to spread him around. And as I took the lid off the box, a fine spray of his ashes blew out onto the table. I couldn't just brush him off, so I wiped my finger over it and snorted the residue. Ashes to ashes, father to son. In a more widespread, though no less personal example, another form of medicinal cannibalism was experiencing an American revival in the 21st century.